Welcome, everyone, to the Farm CPA podcast presented by Top Producer. I am Paul Neifer, your host, and today we're actually going to have a conversation with Roger McGowan from, I'm going to say Kansas/Iowa. Is that the better way of saying it, Roger? Or why don't you explain for the audience where you live and so on and so forth?
Well, I suppose that's fair enough, Paul. My wife and I actually have two homes. We have one in Iowa where she predominantly stays at because our grandchildren are there. I lose out to the grandchildren. I don't think you know about grandchildren yet, Paul, or maybe you do. Do you have one yet?
I actually have two. I have a 3.5-year-old granddaughter. I have a 1.5-year-old grandson, and then I have another grandson on the way. And yes, us fathers or grandfathers, we're not very important.
Right. Yeah. So my wife stays there most of the time. And then we have a place in Kansas that I'm trying to slowly convert into a small farming operation. And we're slashing and burning brush and creating lanes and fixing fences and redoing the pond and again, redoing the pond. And because we had a lot of rain, heavy rains earlier this spring in Kansas, eastern Kansas. Yep. And So it's fair to say that, yeah, Iowa, Kansas, that's kind of where I'm at. Started my career out in Nebraska, so kind of in that Iowa, Nebraska, Kansas area I've been for 30 years.
I just noticed yesterday there was an article came out and said that Panasonic is going to build a big battery factory not too far from where you're at. I think it's probably, what, maybe 30, 40 miles east of you?
Yeah, it's about 50 miles east over near Kansas City, DeSoto, Kansas. I saw that this morning.
Yeah, so that is supposed to be, what, a $4 billion or maybe more than that and 4,000 jobs or something like that. So, that's actually a nice part of Kansas. I've been to Kansas City and surrounding areas probably 50 times in the last 20 years. So I like that area. Well, let's go ahead and get started with your background, where you grew up. I definitely know you have a little bit of a farming background, and let's go ahead and start with that.
Sure. I'm from Northeastern Indiana. I'm the youngest of six. And actually, there's a 25-year age spread between me and the number one child, and then 12 years between number five and me. But I grew up on our Indiana farm. My dad had initially bought 82 acres 70 years ago. this summer, bought that farm 70 years ago. That was the initial tract, and of course, it's been added onto over the years. But he kind of was into everything. We had before I came along, and there was a lot of livestock. And then I guess they were afraid I was going to get trampled. So switched from livestock to row crop farming, and then pheasants and quail, and now chuckers are raised in field pens on that initial 82 acres. And we've got hay and crops on other acreage that we own.
Now, so I've been to a couple pheasant farms. So you're saying it's both pheasant and chuckers, or is it just chuckers, you said?
Pheasants, quail, and chuckers.
Okay.
And a chucker is basically an African partridge. They are beautiful birds, and we release them in the fall for people to come in and hunt.
It's interesting. Of course, my wife really likes raising chickens. We have chickens on our farm. We don't have any quails or pheasants or anything, but we're just in the middle of ordering 75 meat chickens. They're supposed to show up early next month, and so about the middle of September we'll go ahead and process those chickens. So we'll see how that goes. So that's where you grew up. Where did you end up? I have a feeling I know where you went to school, but why don't you share for the audience where you ended up going to school?
Well, I did my undergraduate at Purdue, and so I have a degree in management and ag econ from Purdue, and then did my first year of law school at Indiana University in Bloomington, and then finished up in Iowa. Actually graduated from Drake, and then got my graduate degree at the same time I got my law degree. I got my graduate degree from Iowa State.
Okay. And then go ahead and share with the audience your career as far as where you started and all the way up into where you're at right now.
Well, when I was a second year law student, I actually wrote a law review article that was the first article of its kind on a a new segment of practice, and that had to do with Medicaid planning, you know, asset protection planning, sheltering assets, legally sheltering assets from being depleted to pay for a long-term home care bill. And I published that in the Indiana Law Review I think it was 1991. I was second year of law school, and some people picked that up. National lawyers groups, and I ended up on a speaking circuit still as a second year law student. Well, I was in Minneapolis speaking, talking about that subject, and there were three lawyers that came up to me from North Platte, Nebraska, and one of them in that crowd was Don Kelly. And Don Kelly, you know, I knew who he was. I mean, his books were in the law school library. We used them a lot. He's the author of Estate Planning for Farmers and Ranchers, a multi-volume treatise, and Farm Business Organizations. And that's how I ended up with my first job out in North Platte. And I remember going back to the hotel room. My wife was with me. We had just been married right at 2 years. At that point in time, and told her that, well, I've got a job when I'm done with law school and get past the bar exam. And she said, well, where's that at? And I said, well, it's west of Omaha. And she said, oh, that's great. I like Omaha. Omaha is nice, has lots of shopping and so forth. How far west? About 4 hours. But she was a trooper. She's gone with me. She's gone with me everywhere until the grandchildren came along. I started practicing with Don Kelly, with Kelly Skritzmeyer and Byrne in North Platte, Nebraska. And that firm was probably the number one law firm in the country that had a specific clientele base that was all farmers and ranchers. So it was great to start out with him doing estate planning and tax planning for farmers and ranchers and work with the local CPAs in town. And Don was really good about making sure and emphasizing that we utilized a team approach when it came to estate planning. So it wasn't just the lawyers, although we were drafting the plan and the documents and the wills and the trusts and the entities, but you've got to have, as you know, you've got to have a good tax accountant and CPA that's in on that also, and your life insurance people and your other specialists out there too, to provide kind of the whole package for the client.
Yeah, I notice that happens quite a bit. I'll go into a meeting, and as long as the team is there, sometimes I'll go into the meeting with sort of, I won't necessarily say a preconceived idea, but I sort of have this idea how I want it to go. Mm-hmm. And once we have the meeting with the team, a lot of times my idea almost changes 180%, you know, just because of the fact that collectively we have more knowledge together than we do separately. So I totally agree. It's nice to have that team approach.
Yeah. In fact, I did one this morning in responding to an email of a detailed question in terms of how to set something up. And I looked at that, kind of chewed on it for 3 or 4 days, and then responded just this morning in a lengthy email as to how I would do it. But then I told them, okay, this would be my preferred structure, and it happened to be a member-managed LLC. But I said, you know, I haven't seen the tax returns. I haven't seen existing wills and trusts. I don't know how much income the farming operation is producing, whether that's relevant for payment limitation purposes. But absent that, I would suggest, you know, a member-managed LLC for various reasons. Then I said, however, when you all sit down with the rest of your advisors, take this as just one piece of input, and you're going to have to weigh that against what everybody else says too. So I've always been in favor of the team approach. I think the client is best served by that.
Well, and so many times you and I will sometimes get the exact same email from a practitioner, and we're looking at it, we're going, yeah, we're missing something here, and then you get back to them and you find out, oh, the key thing that we didn't know completely changes the answer that we would give them. So it is, anytime I get emails, I try to respond saying, hey, based on what you've shared, here's my answer, but there may be other things that are going to change that answer too.
Facts matter.
Yeah, exactly. So how many years were you with that firm then?
I was there 2 years, and then I got a call out of the blue from a fellow at K-State that some people listening probably would recognize the name. And it was a kind of a high-pitched, I thought it was strange, a high-pitched kind of weird voice And I was puzzled by it at first, but it was Barry Flinchbaugh at K-State. Calls me out of the blue and said they were wanting to start an ag law program at K-State and would I be interested in it. And of course, I was just getting going in North Platte, building up a client base, and things were going well. And we didn't live in North Platte. We lived about 35 miles north up in the Sandhills in a small town known as Stapleton, Nebraska, where I defaulted into becoming county attorney also. So I had that going on. And I learned that, well, the adjunct they had teaching at K-State wanted to run for Congress. And that happened to be Sam Brownback, who did get elected to Congress and then became a senator and then became governor, two-term governor of Kansas. So I started a program in agricultural law that was split between extension and teaching and research. And I still do that to this day. I still teach that course there and still do extension work for K-State.
Okay. And then from K-State, where did you end up going?
I was at K-State 11 years and then went and started a center for agricultural law at Iowa State and did that for 11 years. And then Washburn Law School came calling. They'd actually been after me for about 20 years and presented me with an opportunity where I could basically write my own contract and split my time between K-State and myself and them. And that was a pretty good deal.
Yeah. And then for those that are not aware where Washburn's at, that's in Topeka, Kansas, which is where your little mini farm is at right now.
Yep. Our place here is about 15 minutes north of downtown Topeka. And I can get to the law school in a half hour. That's usually what I allow. I back out of the garage and I can be in my office in a half hour.
I've been to your place a couple of times and you're right. You've cleared quite a bit of brush since the first time I was there.
I will have to send you some more pictures because we've gone dramatically beyond where we were at last time you were here.
So your current role right now is you do some of that work for K-State. You teach a couple classes or you do some teaching for Washburn, and then you have your various seminars and other things that you do on your own.
I split my time into thirds. K-State gets a third of my time and a separate contract I have for Washburn, and I they get a third of my time, and then I reserve a third of my time for seminars and various media things that I do. K-State, I do teach an undergraduate agricultural law course, and I'm also the serving in the role as the attorney for the Kansas Ag Mediation Service, which is run through K-State. That's been a longstanding program. It was established in the farm debt crisis of the 1980s, and that mediation service is still humming right along, and unfortunately probably will pick up some more business here in the near term. So I do that also, and then I have a full professorship position at the law school under my contract, and I teach at the law school and do seminars for them, and it's all in support of our rural law center at the law school, where we've got students that actually I've recruited from all over the country. We have a couple from Montana right now. We've got some from Florida. We've got some from Texas. So they come from all over because they have an interest in a rural practice. And that's really our emphasis. And as you know, boy, there's a need for that in the rural areas, in the Plain States and out west. We've got a couple counties in Kansas that don't even have a single attorney. So we've got in that rural law program, we've got a couple things our students can do. They can do a summer externship, which is a 6-week externship with a rural firm in, I think it's 22 counties in western and north Kansas, basically from Salina, Kansas, up to the Nebraska border and all points west. And that's funded by a grant from the Hansen Foundation. And we put about 20 students with law firms every summer at no cost to those firms. It's all funded by that,
that grant.
Ensign Foundation. And we've been able to place, the objective is to eventually place those students with those firms. We've been real successful at that. And then looking to expand that into other parts of the country too. And my summer events, which you helped me with as a participant, raises funds for our rural law center. So that's really helpful.
Yeah, I know we sort of face the same difficulties in my area. You know, the little county I'm in has about 2,500 people. There's a couple of attorneys in that town, but the next county over has only got about 1,500 people. And I don't think they have any attorneys that I'm aware of. So,
Yeah, the thing is, Paul, that's one of the issues, and I've had this discussion with legislators because Kansas has a program, for example, that if you're a medical doctor and you take a position in a rural hospital, they'll help pay your medical schooling.
Yeah.
And they like to do that with attorneys, and I've had to slow them down and say, well, look, legal practice is different than a medical practice. There are special rules that apply just to someone that's engaged in farming or ranching. So you have to have specific training in the law to be able to adequately represent a farmer or a rancher client.
Yep.
In the medical field, people are people.
Yeah. Right?
It doesn't matter where they live. So you get your training, you're good to go, whether it's rural or whether it's city. There may be some nuances here and there in terms of the technology you have at your hands, but the people you work with have the same medical issue. But that's not true when it comes to practicing law. You can't take somebody that's gone to a law school that's trained them in all types of issues that have nothing to do with agriculture and then drop them out into a rural setting where, one, they don't understand the terminology, two, they don't understand the economics of farming or ranching, and then three, they don't have any training in the rules that are specific to someone engaged in farming. So that's why we've got that emphasis at the Rural Law Center, is to give them specific training in those agricultural legal issues and agricultural tax issues. You know, tax is different whether you're dealing with a farm client or not in many instances.
Yeah, it's interesting when we have new staff, especially if they don't have any farming or ranching background, and you start getting them involved. I know a lot of times what will happen, we'll explain to them, hey, you know, breeding stock, if we buy breeding stock, we can put that on the depreciation schedule and we can depreciate it. And then suddenly I'm reviewing the depreciation schedule and I go, 15 steers. I'm not sure if steers are breeding stock. So then we have to explain to the staff, you know, a steer is, it really can't do much breeding. You know, it could try, but it's not going to be very effective. So
give them a biology lesson. I had something similar happen to that in the ag law course at the law school this spring, because I spend part of a class session on just on terminology, because you don't want to look like a fool in front of your client. And I'll tell you one other story in just a second, but I was going down through the list and I had on the list Gomer Bull. Well, there's this this young lady in the front row of my class that raises her hand and asks, you know, what's a Gomer Bull? And there was one student in the class who's from a ranch that was just chuckling beyond belief. And I had to explain to her that that's the bull that gets to have all the fun but can't finish the job. And she was embarrassed by that. But then, Paul, even, you know, to illustrate this, I back that up with a case out of Texas that occurred last fall. And it was, this guy was a CPA and an attorney. So he was both. And he had bought 40 acres in Texas, so 50 miles or so to the west of the Dallas metro area. And he wanted to start a cow-calf operation, as the court explains this. And so he decided, for whatever reason, he wanted to buy cows that would calve in the spring, which tells me that he probably was not preparing returns, or else he wouldn't want that. So he goes to the local sale barn in late November one day, and the auctioneer announces that he has 11 Springer cows to sell. And so he gets all excited, runs the bidding up, pays $18,000 for these 11 cows, takes them home, and the first one drops a calf on Christmas Eve, and then by New Year's, he's got six more.
Yep.
And he's he's madder than a hornet right now. He thinks, you know, the veterinarian at the sale barn, when he certified these as Springer cows, lied. The sale barn lied. The auctioneer lied. So he goes to Dallas and finds an attorney and says, oh, yeah, you've been deceived. They throw everything. They file a lawsuit. They throw everything that they can at this sale barn and the veterinarian, you know, Deceptive Trade Practices Act, Fraudulent Conveyances Act, breach of contract, all kinds of legal issues. And you read the court case, and what happened was the court said they got the veterinarian up on the stand, and the lawyer from Dallas for this lawyer CPA asked them, didn't you certify these cows as Springer cows? Yes, sir, I did. Would you please tell the court as to what a Springer cow means? Doesn't that mean that you're certifying that the cow will calve in the spring? And the court pointed out that his response was, well, no, sir. All that means is that she's in her third trimester and she could drop basically at any time.
So
the judge gaveled that case over and assessed cost against the party that brought the suit. So terminology matters. That's why I say you can't just drop an attorney or a CPA out in ag country with ag clients without some background in these things.
Exactly. And then you also mentioned a little bit on the media side. So what do you end up doing on that side?
Well, I've got a lot going on there. I have done a half-hour live radio program every other Monday for a radio station in Topeka, Kansas for 28 years now. And then I have an every other Wednesday program that I've done for about the same period of time through Kansas State University Extension. And those are on every other week basis, and those alternate. So one week I'll have the Topeka station, the next week I'll have K-State, and then back to the Topeka station and back to K-State. So those are routine. And then I have a national daily 2 minute or 1 minute, there's two versions to them, radio program that's heard right now. I think the most recent number is 193 farm radio stations coast to coast, plus Sirius XM every day, 7 days a week, multiple times a day on Sirius. Get about 100 airplays a month on Sirius, plus the daily weekday airplays on the 193 terrestrial radio stations. That daily audience is pushing 3 million. I'm told right now. So it's pretty big. We're trying to get in up into your area, all in the northwestern part of the United States. And that would be the next place that we go to.
And then
every week I do a brief 3-4 minute interview with RFD TV.
Yeah, I'm speaking of that. I have mine today. Normally it would have been at, normally it's at 7 a.m. or excuse me, 9 a.m. Central time. But today I'm pushed back to, I think, noon Central time because they had some changes in the schedule. So I think right now, Roger, we'll go ahead and take a quick break for a sponsor message. And then when we come back, we'll sort of do a little bit of, not a deep dive, but a little bit of dive into some common issues that farmers face. And we'll just go through, maybe give a 1-2 minute little explanation on each of them.
Sounds good.
Get timely updates about taxation, accounting, succession planning, and other issues that are unique to farmers and agribusiness processors. Find out about major agribusiness events and how to comply with new laws that affect your business. Subscribe to Farm CPA at blogs.claconnect.com/agribusiness and experience the CLA promise. blogs.claconnect.com/agribusiness.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Farm CPA podcast presented by Top Producer. I'm your host, Paul Niefer, and we're going to go ahead and rejoin our conversation with Roger McOwen from Washburn University, Kansas State University, and then Roger himself. So, you know, in the news right now, Roger, we have this, I'm going to call it Build Back Better Light. I'm not sure exactly. I don't think it's going to happen anyway, but the one tax provision we know right now is they're trying to impose the net investment income tax on farmers. I'm going to say business owners, but we, our audience here is farmers. And now I'm reading that because of the bird bath rules, it may end up having to be, quote, self-employment tax to get that through. But I would say maybe until the recently, probably certainly 10, 20 years ago, the biggest tax that a farmer faced wasn't income tax, it was self-employment tax. So do you agree with that? And what are some of the things that you see the farmers do to get around that?
Yeah, I do agree with that, particularly for those farms and ranches that haven't done appropriate planning to avoid it. And in many instances, it is easy to significantly reduce the impact of self-employment tax. And some of the ways that they deal with that is to switch the type of lease that they're involved with, maybe to a passive cash lease. But of course, then that can cause other issues from the estate planning side of things in terms of qualifying for post-mortem, post-death estate planning techniques, where you have to have material participation. And there are other tax provisions where you're going to lose some deductions if you're not engaged in farming. And of course, the IRS view is that a cash lease is not a farming activity. So there are pluses and minuses there. Plus, we can form certain types of entities, certain types of LLCs to minimize the self-employment tax bite. But I think you're right. For those, particularly those that haven't done planning, the self-employment tax issue can be a big deal. And, in the past, some had moved toward the S corporation to try to minimize that impact. But for farmers and ranchers, there are probably better options than the S corporation to minimize SE tax. Now, for professional organizations, S corporations. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Farming and ranching operations, we can get there through different doors, so to speak. But, you know, this Build Back Better stuff that you mentioned, of in essence, trying to change the net investment income tax to a tax on business activity, that's pretty rough. And particularly when we see a labor report that just came out showing that inflation's at a year-to-year inflation's at a 41 year high.
Yep.
And at the same time, real wages are declining. You know, go figure that out.
Yeah.
We've got an economic mess, and I think many farmers are pretty thankful for Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema for blocking Build Back Better last year, or else taxes would be higher right now.
Yep. Yeah, yeah. And that's the last thing that we really want is to have higher taxes. So, no. And you're right. S corps are, I think, okay for, like, you and I, we're professional services. S corp would make sense. But for the farmer, there are so many issues with an S corp. You don't have a step up in basis when somebody passes away on the underlying assets. You have basis issues. You have, you can't do special allocations. So definitely. There's other ways of minimizing that SE tax
impact. And I would add to that, I have an S corporation for my personal business, and my wife hates it because she keeps the books for it. And so that's another thing to think about. S corporations are high maintenance organizations.
Yes.
They do require a lot of work, your payroll issues, your basis issues. They do require a lot of work. And to be honest with you, she would tell you she could come in here and give you 5-10 minutes on just how much she hates the S corporation.
Yep. And that's true of most of my clients, I think, at times. Yep. So now, farmers definitely, on when they have property that they want to sell, you know, they're able to use what's called a 1031 exchange. Matter of fact, I had I had another podcast with somebody that handles 1031 exchanges. That's something that farmers are allowed to do, but there's been some restrictions on that over the last few years. Let's just go over that a little bit.
Well, it only applies to real estate now. We used to trade tractors and combines and use the 1031 rules. And I remember, Paul, and you probably had the same experience when the rule changed with TCJA, when that was no longer available for equipment trades. There was a lot of farm media publications that were putting that information out, but then not really explaining that Well, the bottom line tax result may actually be better for a farmer because you're wiping out self-employment tax. And so I had a lot of farmers that were emailing me, and I'm sure you did too, emailing and calling, upset about this, and said, well, my response was, well, you're not going to stop trading them. It's just that we flow it through differently on the return. It becomes a 48-35 issue, and then you wipe out self-employment tax. And then if you want to dig deeper, you get into the issue as to buying and trading equipment as frequently as you do a good idea in terms of a long-term strategy. And that's kind of a separate issue. But yeah, the 1031 issue is just to applies to real estate now. We got some final regulations a year and a half ago or so on, or maybe a year ago on what is the definition of real estate for that purpose. And so we get into some unique issues concerning that. In Kansas, an issue that comes up periodically is whether we can trade water for land. Is water like kind of real estate? And it is, at least under the Kansas water law, it is. Now, in some states, if there are too many restrictions on your water right, it's not going to be like kind of a fee simple in real estate, but it can be in some states such as Kansas.
Yeah, in our states, similar. We have water rights similar to Kansas or Colorado and so on. Now, a federal project would be a little bit different, but if you have fee simple land that you have water to it, you know, you're able to. And actually, right now, I think that water in our state's going for about $3,000 to $5,000 an acre foot. So it's pretty valuable.
And I told back to the media issue. I told a media reporter for print media just a couple of days ago that was asking me about what we focus on in the Rural Law Center. And I said we focus on three what I think are the most essential issues for everybody. And that is the legal rules surrounding food production, water rights and allocation, and energy. Those three aspects of society, I think, Paul, are the core. We've got to have food, we've got to have water, we've got to have energy. And so our students need to know the legal rules and the tax rules associated with those three core components of the economy. And that's why what you and I do, I think, is so essential.
Yeah. Well, and you mentioned that on personal property, the trades, you know, it's from a tax standpoint, it's been sort of a moot point other than certain state issues. Well, now you and I have been getting questions and I know certainly I've been dealing with it that on this new emergency relief program, you know, FSA says, well, gains on equipment are not farm income unless more than 2/3 of your other income from farming is greater than overall income. Yeah. And what I've heard their response is, well, you know, the reason that's in there is because the IRS doesn't consider equipment gains to be farm income. And yes, that's correct. But then why do you have this thing that says if your farm income is greater than 2/3, you get to count it? Yeah. Or why do you allow these other items of income, such as cash rent from renting farmland or wind turbine income? Right. Why is that allowed to be farm income? So don't give me that excuse that the IRS doesn't allow it. That doesn't wash very well with me.
Right. So. Yeah. And those rules that they've come up with on that program aren't even consistent, for example, with the rules for what is farm income for the farm income averaging provision.
No, I know.
So, and it would be nice to have consistency from provision to provision, but those ERP rules are a tangled mess right now.
Yeah. Well, and I know hopefully there'll be some pressure placed on FSA to sort of clean this up. Now we'll see if that happens. Now, luckily, you know, for those listening on this, you know, the deadline for getting your application in is July 22nd, but you have at least 60 days after that to get the FSA 510 in that allows you to get that extra payment if it's applicable. So we still have plenty of time. Don't worry about that. A couple other items, you know, the one unique thing about a farm manufacturing company, because a farm is a manufacturing, you know, you're taking raw material, you're taking seed and you're planting it and you're applying some inputs to it. And then you come up with a finished good is that farmer is allowed to sell their product on an installment basis. We call it a deferred payment contract. What are some of the issues that you commonly find with those deferred payment contracts?
Not getting it in writing. that's a big one. Just sloppiness on that. And those contracts do need to be in writing, because the IRS needs to know that you are dealing with specific agricultural goods, whether you're prepaying or whether you're using a, trying to sell on a deferred basis, get those contracts in writing, prepay your expenses under a written contract, get into a written deferred contract that follows the specific IRS guidelines that they put out on those almost 30 years ago. I think the 1994 guidelines that are still good. Prepayments and also on deferred payment contracts too. So there are specific rules. They do need to be followed. Best to get both of those types of contracts in writing.
And we've definitely seen some IRS activity in this area. I know certainly on the deferred payment contract side, I think I had one discussion with an attorney maybe a year and a half ago. I think it was $30 or $40 or $50 million of deferred payment contracts that between you and I think you probably talked to the same attorney, they didn't really have much of a leg to stand on. I mean, the record keeping and what they were asserting was so, you know, you're just not going to win, you know? So
this is an issue that IRS is litigating. I'm aware of one pending case in tax court right now that's waiting to go to trial. And I think the amount in controversy is about $56 million in that case. So you have to be very, very careful with these contracts and get them drafted properly.
Well, and then, like you say, over on the prepaid farm expense side, how many times have you had an IRS audit and you find out that the record essentially said $800,000 or $500,000 or $300,000 deposit? You know, that's not a prepaid farm expense.
You don't use that term.
Or it is not.
We'll call it that. The other thing with deferred payment contracts, Paul, that we've seen over the past year was there was a big case filed involving a bank in Kansas City and an elevator down in the Delta area of Arkansas/Mississippi. And what happened was that and you're probably aware of this, when the elevator was making representations that it was financially sound, and so farmers were being encouraged to enter into deferred payment contracts with them. Well, the bank had been, the elevator was behind. They were basically in default, and the bank was letting them slide until the fall harvest came in. Well, when the fall harvest came in and farmers delivered, then they had some commodities at the elevator, and the bank foreclosed on the loan, and a lot of farmers were left holding the bag. And so they filed a class action lawsuit back against the bank. So that's still hanging out there. But you have to be very careful when you enter into a deferred payment contract that you have some sort of security. And so some of the other areas we look at, there are some court cases on this. Pretty much all of them involve cotton, in that there might be a way to set up an escrow account or a letter of credit so that you have at least some level of security after you deliver and before you get paid, in case that elevator goes belly up.
Yeah. That's you know, definitely something, especially when you're dealing with a private, smaller private type elevator. You know, that's, you know, if you're dealing with the large ones, ADM, Cargill, et cetera, you know, you're probably going to be okay there. So then over on the succession side, you know, a lot of farm operations, they operate as a farm partnership. Mm-hmm. But because of the fact that they have no basis, you know, the equipment's been fully written off, we never have basis in the crop, and they have debt, you know, that we have what we call negative capital accounts. And even if the farmer wants to gift that over to the next generation, that creates tax consequences. So what are you seeing in that area? What are some of the common pitfalls, or what do you see happening to sort of help mitigate that, if possible?
Well, what we want to do in those situations is to see if we can eliminate that debt before we get the structure in place, because it's always easiest to work with clients that don't have any or have little debt involved. And so the first step is to try to see what you can do to make that go away. Absent that, I think we have to start with a recognition that succession planning and partnerships with negative capital accounts That latter point, you know, that's a real issue. And when we talk about succession planning, I just saw some recent numbers this spring coming out of USDA where there's a massive amount. Well, a third of existing farmers are over 65 years of age, and another third are over age 55.
Yeah.
So you take that, you got two thirds of farming operations that are operated by people that are likely to retire within the next 10 years. Now, retire, I would put that word in quotes when it's applied to a farmer or a rancher. Do we really retire or not? And that's where succession planning comes in. So if you've got that partnership and you've wiped out your basis and all your assets because, frankly, the tax laws in Congress have encouraged you to do so.
Yep.
With fast methods of depreciation. That's where I go back to my comment earlier. Is it really a good thing to be doing, you know, trading every 2 years or taking these massive amounts of depreciation? Is that you're really kind of the best thing you need to be doing when you look at your overall tax plan? But we deal with that. And the tough thing is to explain to clients what the tax bite's going to be with having these negative capital accounts.
Yeah, yeah.
That's why I go back to what I started. We want to get rid of that that issue before we start to get serious with succession planning, if we can. Sometimes we can't, and so we just have to factor in and explain to clients that, yeah, there's going to be a tax bite, and how are we going to pay that tax, and where's it going to come from, and who's going to get saddled with it?
Of course, sometimes I tell my clients, and they don't always like hearing this, but I go, the best way to get rid of this is you pass away, then your heirs get a step up and they don't owe that tax. Nobody owes the tax. But you know, my client typically doesn't want to go through that process, and I understand that. So, a couple other things is that, like you say, you have this trend of lots of farmers being 55 or older. You know, two-thirds of the farmers are out there that are at that age. Do you see, what are you optimistic that there's younger farmers that are going to come in to take their place? Or, you know, you and I are out there on the road, both of us spend probably 100 days or more on the road. What are you seeing out there as far as a trend of that next generation really wanting to come in and help take over for those farmers that are getting ready to retire?
Well, that's an interesting question. I do a lot of farmer meetings. I do about 80 to 100 meetings a year. Now, they're not all for CPAs and attorneys. I do a lot for extension, and so that's late-level meetings. And I try to ask it, particularly the lay-level meetings, where we've got farmers and ranchers, and it might be a dinner meeting, or it's usually not what you and I are used to, an 8-hour seminar, maybe one day or 2 days at the same location. So 16 hours, you know, this may be a couple of hours wrapped around a meal. And by the way, the meal at these farmer meetings is fabulous. I've benefited from those for almost 30 years. They're just great. Which my wife still shakes her head and says, how do you not ever gain any weight? But nevertheless, you know, I try to ask a question at each one of those as to whether they have a succession plan in place. Do you have an estate plan in place? Do you have a basic will or trust? And I'm stunned, Paul, frankly. And it's not changed in 30 years. I've been doing this for 30 years, and I've asked that question at many places that I've been all over the country. I am stunned that it's probably easily less than a third that have some sort of plan in place.
Yeah.
I don't know what your feeling is on that, but I'm just amazed that people have not done the planning. And then I've got a slide that I use in some of my presentations, and I think I put it up at the one you and I did earlier this summer in Wisconsin, and that is that you'll spend $6,000 to $8,000, maybe $10,000 on a tire for a combine, a spreader tire, but you won't spend that much money to preserve your legacy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you can literally hear a pin drop. Yeah. And I'll see some of the farm wives kind of elbow jab their husbands in the side of the ribs. And, you know, they're nodding their head. Yeah. But that kind of brings it home to reality. And then the other question I asked to follow that up when there's silence is, you know, how much sand is in the top of your hourglass?
Yeah.
Well, we don't know.
And nobody knows.
And I find with people, Paul, one of the hardest things for them is to get started. They don't know where to start.
Yep.
And if you can get them engaged in the process, I like to make people start out by just listing out what you own and what you owe on it. Just force them to go through listing out their assets. Give me a balance sheet. What you own, what's it worth, what do you owe on it? And then after that, now tell me what you want to do with all this stuff. Yeah. So it gets them engaged in the process. It gets them off of that hump where they don't do anything. And I also find that a lot of farm people, they want to say, well, I want to treat my kids equally. I want to be fair to all my kids. Well, if you start at that point, you're never going to get started, because that's a subjective thing, and you're never going to solve that. You just have to start and figure out how you're going to satisfy what your objectives are once you figure those out. But you can't start from the premise, well, I want to be fair, because you're never going to figure out what fair is.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's also important for farmers to understand, especially in the last couple of years with the rapid increase in land values, we need to know what that land is worth, not what you conservatively tell the bank it's worth.
Right.
We need to know, hey, if the local market, well, and I have some ground in Eastern Iowa that I paid $6,000 an acre for it in the middle of the pandemic. I lucked into it. I'm not brilliant. I was lucky on it. Mm-hmm. You know, there's land a mile away that just got listed for $15,000 an acre, and it's not as good a ground as mine.
I don't doubt it.
And, you know, on my balance sheet, I still have that ground, maybe at like, I probably wrote it up to $8,000 or $9,000 an acre. But if I was to pass away, it is $15,000 an acre. And that's what we need to understand when we're dealing with your estate plan, not what you conservatively think it is. It's what is it really worth if you were to pass away tomorrow and it went to auction? That's the important number. So
sometimes those values go up dramatically like that. And sometimes you have a 1981 in Iowa where they drop 50% in 18 months.
Yeah. And if we keep having a large increase in interest rates, you know, likely the Fed's going to bump it at least 100, we know at least 75. Now it's probably going to be 100 basis points because Canada just did the same. So, at some point you may see a softening in those land values. So, Roger, this has been good. I think maybe we'll have another podcast a little bit in the future, and we'll come back on some other topics. But is there anything else that you'd like to add?
No, other than if people are interested in where you and I are at, we're going to be in Durango together and at the start of August.
Durango, Colorado, which right now I'm in Colorado Springs looking out at Pikes Peak as we do this seminar, and Durango is just as nice.
Looking forward to it.
Okay, thanks, Roger. Again, this is the Farm CPA Podcast presented by Top Producer. I am Paul Neefer, your host, signing off.